The crime of passion defense in halakha. What we're going to talk about in this shiur is the question of whether halakha recognizes the claim that a particular act was a crime of passion as a legitimate defense in halakha criminal law. That is to say, whether one can evade punishment, or at the least mitigate punishment, because one's action was committed under internal compulsion, that even though one does not admit being genuinely insane, overall, one claims to have been in a situation in which a sane person could not control themselves under the weight of particular emotions. Now, at first glance, it would seem that halakha and Torah have a deep theological objection to the claim that one, human beings are ever not capable of controlling themselves. The message of Torah is that human beings are in fact capable of choosing good over evil, of choosing life over death, and therefore the whole task of the human being is to control their impulses towards evil. So to say that one should not be held responsible because of one's emotions can, prima facie, be seen as going against the entire thrust of Torah. Furthermore, we should note that the crime of passion defense in Western law, I believe most famously in the Code of Napoleon, tended to be applied in a very particular case, which is when one spouse found the other spouse engaged in bed, right? Engaged in sexual activity, in flagrante delicto, I think is the term, and was so overcome by emotion that they killed either the adulterous spouse, the third party, or whomever. And usually this is a husband finding a wife in bed with somebody else and killing the wife and her lover. So the classic example of the crime of passion defense in Western law is when the emotions aroused by the marital relationship or by a sexual relationship overcome one's capacity to obey the law. We'll see that if in fact halakha recognizes such a case, one of the prime examples will be a reverse case in which the passion for law overcomes one's any natural inclination towards forming a marital relationship. So you'll see whether you think it's in fact the same thing. But I'm starting with the premise that the burden of proof is against such a claim, and I want to see if, in fact, one can, despite that, construct a compelling case that halakha recognizes this defense, or at least that there is a strand in halakha that recognizes such a defense. Now, the first case, historically, within the world of Rabbinic Judaism, in which such a plea was made, is really at the very beginning of the Jewish nation. Immediately after the revelation at Sinai, Matan Torah, the Jews commit the sin of the golden calf, and Moshe Rabbeinu attempts to defend the Jews to God for committing the golden calf, and that turns us to source number one. Now, source number one begins with the phrase V'dizahav. V'dizahav is part of a list of places at the very beginning of Dvarim, of Deuteronomy, which are the places at which Moses delivered the speech, which forms the bulk of Dvarim. The problem is that those places do not conform to the list of places that the Jews visited in the desert according to the end of Sefer Bamidbar of Numbers. Therefore, the rabbis concluded that the names used for places in the beginning of Sefer Dvarim must be symbolic. They must represent something, events, rather than actually be the names of places. So what is represented by the name Dizahav? So here we have the Talmud and the Tractate Brachot, Lamed Bet Amud Aleph, page 32a, quoted saying the following, Mai v'Dizahav, what is meant by the name Dizahav? Amri Devei Rabbi Yanai, the house of Yanai said, Kach amar Moshe lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So said Moses before the Holy One who is blessed. Ribono shel Olam, Master of the Universe, Bishvil kesev v'zahav shishpata lehem liYisrael ad sh'amru dai, hu garam shasu et egel. It's the silver and gold that you sacrament that you poured out for the Jews until they said enough. Right? So V'di Zahav becomes V'dai Zahav, right? Which Dai means enough. So you gave them Dai Zahav, so much gold that they said enough. That's what caused them to commit the sin of the golden calf. Okay, how is it that God can be held responsible for the Jews' sin simply because he gave them too much good? So the Talmud continues with the following analogy. Amar Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba said the name Rabbi Yochanan. Mashal, I'll give you a parable to explain what Moshe Rabbeinu's argument was. Le'adam echad shayalo ben. There was a person who had a son. Hirchitzo, so he bathed him, v'sacho, and he anointed him, or perfumed him, v'echilo, and he fed him, v'ishkahu, and he gave him drink, probably intoxicating drink, v'talalo kis al tzavaro, and he put a locket or some kind of container of perfume, right, of perfume, I guess we would say cologne, on his neck, v'hoshivo al petach shel zonot, and then he takes this dressed up, well-fed, possibly somewhat inebriated son, and he puts him at the doorway of a brothel. Ma yaseh oto haben shelo yechta? What could that boy do not to sin? So the analogy seems to be that when overwhelmed with quantities of gold and silver, it's the nature of human beings to worship them. And therefore, God caused the sin of the golden calf by giving them so much gold and silver that the Jews had no choice but to worship it. Now, this argument, Moshe Rabbeinu's argument for the Jews, is not necessarily accepted by God. It's very ambiguous as to how God reacts to Moshe's plea. He ends up not destroying the Jews utterly. On the other hand, the punishment of the golden calf is visited on the Jews in every generation when they sin. So it's not clear how effective this claim of Moshe Rabbeinu that the Jews were placed in a situation in which they could not control themselves, what I would call a crime of passion situation, passion for gold in this case. It's not clear that God accepts Moshe Rabbeinu's argument even as a mitigating factor, but possibly it functions as a mitigating factor. What's also not clear, right, that's the nimshal, right, the object of the parable. But what about the actual case? What would Rav Chiya bar Abba have said, or Rav Yochanan have said, if an adolescent came before him charged with patronizing a brothel, and the defense was, well, my father bathed me and fed me and perfumed me and gave me drink and put me down at the doorway. How could I not go in? Would we take that as a claim legitimate to avoid responsibility or not? And that question, I don't know. I don't think that there is any real evidence in halakha one way or the other as to how we take it. But here we have the first instance of such a plea. It may or may not have been effective in the use of Moshe Rabbeinu even as a mitigating factor. It seems to me that Rav Chiya bar Abba and Rav Yochanan would at least have taken it as a mitigating factor. I don't know if they would have taken it as a complete exemption. I doubt it very much, but at least as a mitigating factor. Okay, that brings us to source number two. Source number two is found in a Tosfot, Tractate Shabbat, Dav Dalad Amud Aleph, Dibur HaMatchil Ki, page 4a in Tractate Shabbat. Tosfot quotes the following case. V'gabe chetziyah shivcha v'chetziyah bet chorin shen ha'agum b'minhag hefker. So in the case of a woman who was half slave and half free, meaning that you had a female slave who was owned by two masters, one of whom gave her a writ of manumission, so that she's now half free. Such a woman is ineligible for marriage at all, because as a slave she cannot marry a free Jew, as a Jew she cannot marry a slave, and if she were to find somebody in the same position, the halakha is that we don't match up the halves, but we say that they cannot marry each other either. So such a woman is in a position in which she is ineligible for marriage, and therefore it seems that the men of the population treated her as fair game. Right? They treated her licentiously. And therefore, v'chafu et rabba. So the rabbis of the time forced the remaining master to free her. Right? They said that one should not, a slave should not long endure half slave and half free. So Tosfot wants to know, there is a rabbinic principle, after this halakha is, that there is a prohibition against freeing, and we're dealing here with a Canaanite slave. Right? In a different share, I'll discuss why there should be such a prohibition and why we can view such a prohibition as an affirmation of autonomy rather than as a denial. But let's just take it at face value here that there is a prohibition against freeing Canaanite slaves. So on what grounds do we force the remaining master to commit a halachic crime, really, of freeing a Canaanite slave? So Tosfot says, Mishum shahaita michazeret umotzia atzma liznut, because this particular woman was acting lewdly. Right, she was making herself available for uncommitted sex. The domim la anusim, and therefore the men of the environment, it seems to me, Tosfot is saying, are considered to be as if they were compelled. The domim la anusim, there is if they're compelled. There's no physical compulsion in the sense nobody is taking over their will, which right external compulsion, which halacha certainly recognizes, but it seems that the availability of sexual relations without any responsibility is treated as an unconquerable temptation for men. And Tosfot says that rather than reacting to this by saying, well, control yourselves, we recognize that such a compulsion requires us to act legally in ways we would not, in this particular case, to force somebody else to commit an act, or depending on how you learn it, we declare that act, which, if purposeless, would be a violation, to not be a violation since it has a legitimate legal purpose. So here again, we have a case in which we say that under particular circumstances, people are not viewed as entirely responsible for their actions, such that we change the law because we treat them as if they were compelled. Now, again, I don't think that Tosfot read the Gemara as saying that were those men to be on trial for having extramarital sex, right, or for having sex with a slave, that we would absolve them of legal responsibility, of criminal responsibility, because they're as if compelled. But we see that halacha does not treat one as equally responsible in all cases, because we don't, in cases where we don't see the temptation as extraordinary, as if they were compelled, we would not react legally to mitigate the situation. Okay, that brings us to source number three. Source number three, again, is a Tosfot found in Tractate Sanhedrin, Tet Amud Bet, Tractate Sanhedrin 9b. Tosfot there is explaining the position of Rava. Rava says that although the general position is that any Jew who regularly violates a biblical prohibition is thereby becomes invalid as a witness in halachic courts, because we presume that somebody who is willing to violate one biblical commandment will equally well violate the biblical commandment against bearing false witness. Right? We treat the violation of one biblical commandment as revelatory of character, and we say that a person who can't be trusted to follow one aspect of Torah should not be trusted to follow any aspect of Torah. However, Rava says that this does not necessarily apply to persons suspected of committing acts of heterosexual immorality. Why should that be? So Tosfot says, Inami, another explanation is, Hasam, Kasher, people who are suspected of, or are known to have committed sexual immorality in a way that violates biblical law, are nonetheless still valid witnesses, mishum diyitzro tokfo kol kach, because their desire, their inclination overwhelms them to the point, v'chashiv ka'onis, that they're considered as if compelled. So here again, it doesn't mean that we don't hold people criminally liable for their acts of, say, adultery. However, that doesn't necessarily disqualify them. And I'm not sure that Rava would go so far as adultery, but very possibly. It doesn't necessarily disqualify them as witnesses, because we can say that that particular action is not reflective of their character, because we view them as if they were compelled for this purpose. Right, it says we have three different cases, one in the Talmud and two in Tosfot, and if you accept Tosfot's interpretation, we then have three cases in the Talmud, in which we recognize a plea of internal compulsion as having at least mitigating force in halacha. All this is brought together in, to some degree, it shows legitimacy, on the other hand, it's a reductio ad absurdum by the Or HaChaim commentary on Numbers 11:10, David Berger Aleph Yud, where he says, "Shekol oseh rish'al etzad tikboret ha-pitui v'arevus," anybody who engages in an act of wickedness because of the power, right, because they're overcome by seduction and sweetness, desire for pleasure, yesh ladun bo tzad ha-ones, there's always room to look upon them without utter severity, because of the element of compulsion in human nature to be seduced by pleasure. So here again, clearly he's not talking about legal responsibility, but he is willing to say that all cases in which one acts out of desire for pleasure as opposed to out of desire to anger God should be seen as having a mitigating element. However, of course, the problem is that once we say that you can view this in almost every case, so clearly its legal force has to be very weak, because we don't refuse to apply a regimen of punishment. Although it might be that the Or HaChaim is part of the impetus behind the, for example, the position that several Litanayim have, that one should, despite the fact that the Torah frequently prescribes the death penalty for crimes, that a court should make sure that it does not apply such a penalty more than once in every 7 years, or more than once every 70 years, or never, according to Rabbi Akiva. So it might be that that's because, although people who commit acts solely out of defiance of God, in fact, deserve such punishments, but anybody who acts out of desire should be seen as at least somewhat compelled, and therefore not be subject to the full severity of the law. Maybe. What we have so far, again, is a series of cases that seem to indicate that halacha recognizes at least some degree of impairment of responsibility, which generates mitigating circumstances, even when the compulsion is purely internal. And the phrase continually shows up that there is if they are compelled. And so the analogy is explicit. The first move we have towards taking this more strongly and suggesting this might have halachic effect to the point of really absolving someone of legal responsibility, we can find in the commentary of Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, also one of the authors of the Tosafot, to Shemot Chaf Bet Aleph, Exodus 22:1. This is source number 5. So he's commenting on the phrase Im b'machteret yimetzei haganav, which the Torah says that if somebody finds a thief entering their house furtively, right, they find the thief in a tunnel, entering their house, and you kill that thief, so ein lo damim, right, we don't hold you responsible for the killing of the thief. So why not? So Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor explains this as following. Kilomar, what this means to say is, ein ha-makeo nechshav k'shofech damim, right, meaning the, let's assume, the owner of the house who strikes down the furtive thief is not considered to have shed the thief's blood, or is not considered to be a bloodshedder. Sharei kimo onusu, because he, the householder, is as if compelled. She'en adam yachol hamid atzmo al mamono, because people are incapable of restraining themselves when their money is at stake. Right, so Yosef Bechor Shor says, It's not that one has a right to kill the furtive trespasser, but that we absolve you of criminal responsibility for killing the trespasser, because human beings cannot restrain themselves when their money is threatened in their home. Okay, so it seems here that Rabbeinu Yosef B'Chor Shor, using the same language as we saw in the previous sources, that somebody is considered as if compelled, here uses it to explain the law in the Torah, which says that actually you have no criminal responsibility at all. So it would seem that Rabbi Yosef B'Chor Shor, in principle, accepts the idea of a claim of crime of passion, in this case, passion for money, although aggravated, of course, by the notion that one is being violated by one having one's home invaded furtively. What we then have to figure out is, in evaluating Rabbi Yosef B'Chor Shor, is, number one, is he right in his explanation of this case? Is it really true that the reason a householder is not held liable for killing a furtive trespasser is because the householder is compelled? There might be another better reason that when we read the Talmud that we're convinced is the reason that the householder is not held responsible. And secondly, even if we were to decide that is the correct explanation of the case, is the Torah telling us in this case that the householder is not liable, is the Torah thereby telling us that we can build from here, we can derive from here, a binyan av, we can use this as a paradigm to teach us the legitimacy of the crime of passion defense? Or is it saying that ordinarily this case is not such a defense would not be accepted, but here the Torah tells us this is the exceptional case? And this, by the way, I think is also a case that I'm not going to cite in the context of the shir, the case of Yifat Tawar, of the attractive captive, whom one is allowed to take home and possibly or possibly not rape, where it seems in that case that Torah is acknowledging compulsion. So without even getting into that case, it seems to me very hard to generalize from that case. It seems to me that the point there is that what the Torah is saying is the chiddush. Right? Even though you would never accept this, this case is so weird, so wild that we're going to allow it. And even there, it's not 100% clear. But here it seems to me there's a better chance of saying that we can derive from here the principle in general if we accept B'Chor Shor's reading, and then again if we could find some indication that somebody saw this as a paradigm and not as an exception. So let's first try and evaluate whether Rav Yosef B'Chor Shor's reading of this particular law is compelling. So to evaluate that, we have to go back to what is here source number 6 of the Gemara on Sanhedrin in Bet Amud Aleph, page 72a, which discusses this very case. All right, so the Mishnah begins by saying, Hababa machtera nidon al shem sofo. Right, a furtive trespasser is judged by his end. Okay, what does it mean to be judged by his end? So Amar Rava said, "My tamad machteret." What's the reason that the householder is absolved for killing the furtive trespasser? Chazakash ein adam ma'amid atzmo al mamono. There is a rabbinic presumption, a legal presumption, that people do not restrain themselves when it comes to their money. V'hai meimar Amar. So this furtive trespasser, this thief, is saying to himself, Iyazilma, if I go and try and steal money from this house, Koilapoi, the owner will come face me. The thief is acknowledging the possibility that he will be discovered, even though he's trying to enter furtively. Philoshavically, and the owner will not allow me to take the money, the owner will confront me. Vikoilapoi, and so the thief is saying to himself, and prepared to say, well, if the owner confronts me, Ketilale, I will kill the owner. V'atorah amra, imbala hargacha hashkem lahargo. And the Torah says, which is a fun phrase because in Rabbinic idiom, when it actually uses the words v'atorah amra, right, the Torah says what it really means is that there is no explicit verse that says this, but we see this as a principle derivable from the Torah. Imbala hargacha, if somebody comes to kill you, hashkem lahargo, then you should anticipate, hasten, and kill that person first. So what's the explanation of this case? It seems to me that one could read this case in two ways, very differently than the Chorshor, and the Rishonim offers such readings. One possibility is that once the confrontation is initiated, so the thief is the one who makes it a capital confrontation, because the thief is the one who is prepared to kill. And the householder has no interest in killing, the householder just wants to protect his money, but the thief is willing to kill to get the money, and so now, once the confrontation happens, the householder is just there, the thief is now prepared to kill, and the householder is entitled to act out of self-defense. So you might ask, so why isn't the thief entitled to act out of self-defense? And in that case, maybe the householder has an obligation to leave. So one could argue that the householder has no obligation to leave. One could argue that we have here what is called an unclean hands doctrine, meaning that whether or not the householder should have left, since the thief committed the first wrong act, so when a wrong act creates an escalation, a vicious cycle of wrong acts done to each other, we hold the person who committed the first wrong act responsible. And therefore, the thief is considered to be the one who initiates the capital confrontation, even though the thief would be very happy if the owner said, take my money, I really have no interest in fighting. But because the thief committed the first wrong act of entering the house illegitimately, therefore we hold the thief responsible. The Chorshor has the creative reading that, in fact, the owner is formally under obligation not to make this a capital confrontation. That confronted by the thief, right, if the owner cannot overpower the thief, the owner should let the thief get away. Or the owner should, and better yet, if the owner knows that the only way they will be able to stop the thief is by killing them, the owner should not initiate the confrontation. However, the Chorshor says, once the owner initiates the confrontation, or better yet, the Chorshor says that even though the owner should not initiate the confrontation, we don't hold the owner responsible for initiating the confrontation. And therefore, even though the owner could be considered a murderer, because if the owner had just not gone in there, the thief had no intention of killing him, so we could say that the owner really is the one who is the threat, and it's the thief who's acting out of self-defense. The Chorshor says that we can't hold people accountable. We can't say that you're obligated to not confront a thief who breaks into your house. That's not reasonable. So that's Bechor Shor's reading, but as I say, it seems to me at least equally plausible to read the Gemara as the other Rishonim do and say that the issue here is an unclean hands doctrine, or that we genuinely view the thief as walking in and thereby initiating the capital confrontation. So what we have so far, I would say, is one Rishon who seems to suggest this, and one Rishon who seems to suggest this. And again, we also don't know that he says this as a rule, as opposed to simply as an explanation of this particular case.
I should note that Chorshor
does indicate in one other place that he believes that this claim that one killed under internal compulsion has legal results, because he uses this to defend Moshe Rabbeinu for killing the Egyptian in outrage at the injustice committed by the Egyptian, even though it seems clear from the Chorshor that the Egyptian did not deserve death. And we'll perhaps return to that at the end of the shir. Okay, we're now moving on to source number 7. We're now going to quote a series of cases and see if they provide genuine Talmudic evidence for the legitimacy of such a plea. So the first case, which is source number 7 in your packet, Shabbat Daf Kufnun Gimel Lamed Aleph, Shabbat 153a, Says the following: Misha hechshich baderech, somebody who was traveling at sunset on Friday, meaning that they're traveling when Shabbat hits and they haven't reached their destination, and in particular they're carrying their money on Shabbat, and so what they can do is notain kisol nachri. So if a Jew traveling at sunset on Shabbat, on Friday evening should or is entitled to give his purse to a non-Jew to carry. But if he has no non-Jew with him, manichol achamor, then he can put it on his own donkey. Okay, even though each of these are usually violations, in particular, giving the purse to the non-Jew to carry for you to your destination is a violation of the general principle of amira l'nachri, that you are not allowed to ask a non-Jew to perform actions for you on Shabbat that you, the Jew, would not be allowed to perform yourself. So the Gemara asks, "My tama shorle rabbanan lemesav kisei l'nachri." So what is the reason that the rabbis gave him permission, in this case, to give his purse to the non-Jew and thereby ask the non-Jew to do something that he would himself be permitted to doing? So kimluhu l'rabbanan, right? The rabbis affirmed, meaning the rabbis took as a legal principle of fact, de'ein adam amidat small amono, that a person does not restrain themselves with regard to their money. Ilo sharitleis, if you would not permit him, ati lisuya dalad amas prashus rabim, then the person would himself come to violate the biblical prohibition against carrying an object 4 cubits in a public domain. So here it seems at first hand that we have a confirmation of Bechor Shor's position, because here, as a result of the claim in adam amidat small mamono, we have a direct legal consequence, right? There's no indirect consequence as a result leading to some other phenomenon because of unclean hands or anything like that. Here, because ein adam amidat small mamono, because people do not restrain themselves with regard to their money, therefore we permit something which would otherwise be prohibited, namely handing the purse to a non-Jew. So there are two things. First of all, here, I should note again that Bechor Shor said, "In adam yachol hamira asmal mamono." Bechor Shor said people are incapable of doing so, whereas the Talmud simply says that people do not. Right? Talmud may be describing what most people will do without saying that people could not exercise will and act better. And that's particularly significant here because what's going on here is not actually, we're not actually letting the person get away with something forbidden. It's not that we're not holding the person legally accountable for handing the purse to the non-Jew. What's really happening here is that the reason the rabbis forbade asking a non-Jew to do something that you could yourself not do is because we're afraid that asking a non-Jew will end up leading you to do it yourself. Right? This is a protective rabbinic legislation. But in this particular case, the legislation would be counterproductive, because it actually would lead to more people violating the biblical prohibition, because people would say, if there's no permitted way of getting my wallet home, then I might as well carry it myself, which will make me more secure. So this is a case in which the rabbis chose not to legislate. So the act actually becomes entirely permitted. It's not that we're absolving you of responsibility for violating the rabbinic prohibition, it's that the act becomes permitted. And for the rabbis to choose this, they don't have to believe that it was impossible for you to restrain yourself. They don't have to believe that no one would have or could have simply left their purse where it was and gone on. They simply have to believe that most people, or a significant number of people, wouldn't do so, because people don't always do the right thing even if they can. And therefore, they thought that the way in which they could minimize the number of biblical violations would be to allow this action entirely legally, not to absolve somebody, but to allow it. So I don't think you can demonstrate here that the Bechor Shor is correct, that that we say that people are incapable of restraining themselves with regard to their money, and that therefore we absolve them of liability for their acts. Okay, let's move on to source number 8. Source number 8 is from a work called the Kovetz Ha'arot on Masechet Yevamot, which is written by Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman. It says the following: V'ramam sham od zelashon. Another Ramam there says further, Mi shechashka nafsho b'torah tamid. Somebody whose soul adores Torah continually. V'shogeba kiven azai. And he steeps himself in it, like Rabbi Shimon ben Azai. V'davak ba kol yamav. And he cleaves to it all his days. V'lo nasa isha. And therefore, he never marries. Ein v'yado avon. Right? He has not sinned. Even though the Rambam says earlier that anybody who reaches the age, any male who reaches the age of 20 unmarried, has committed a grievous violation. So why here does he have no sin? So the context of this is that in general, right, we believe that when we have a conflict between learning Torah and other mitzvot, so learning Torah takes priority unless the other mitzvah is one whose time will pass. And Rabbi Elchanan had previously explained this as meaning that you're allowed to delay other mitzvot for the purpose of Torah, but you're not allowed to put them off. You're not allowed to be mevatel them. You're not allowed to entirely annul them. So, Rav Elchanan says, in this case, we're saying if you die without getting married, so you haven't just put the mitzvah off, you have in fact been mevatel the mitzvah. So why do we say that you have not sinned? So there are other explanations, but I'm interested particularly in Rabbi Elchanan's explanation. He's, as of now, he says, the venira de be'emes ki haigavna eino patur mitzvah piravirivya. So it seems to him, he says, that even in a case like Ben Azai, where you adore Torah continually, you're not exempt from the mitzvah of procreation. Ela dechashiv ka'anus bevitula. But you're considered to be compelled in your nullification of that commandment. Ukulashon ha-Rambam, right, and he says, if you read the Rambam carefully, the Rambam's language implies this. So the Rambam says, Ein biado avon, he has no sin in his hand. The Rambam doesn't say that he's acted properly. Right? The Rambam says he has no sin in his hand, which Rav Elchanan reads, I think, with good justification, as saying that you're not held responsible for an act that is objectively sin. V'hainu de Ben Azai, right? Meaning, as in the case of Ben Azai, haya davuk kol kach b'Torah, who was so attached to Torah, shelo haya yachol hasiach dato yimeno l'davar acher, that he was incapable, in fact, of removing his mind to actually engage in a human relationship. Right? The Talmud elsewhere suggests that Ben Azai, in fact, had been married, but was incapable of sustaining the marriage. Right? So Rav Elchanan says it's not that such a person is exempt from procreation, it's simply that we can't hold them responsible for not procreating, because in order to procreate, you have to marry. In order to marry, you have to form a genuine relationship. And Ben Azai's relationship with Torah was so strong that he could not form another relationship. Okay, so it seems that Rav Elchanan Wasserman here is willing to accept the claim of internal compulsion for Torah. Right here again, it's the passion for the law overriding one's physical desire for sex to such a point that we can't hold you accountable for failing to engage in sexual relations, which I think is an interesting, ironic twist on the classic Western case. And Rav Elchanan seems to take this as a compelling legal plea. So the question is, does that go far enough to prove Bechor Shor's contention that there is such a plea in criminal cases? So there are a number of ways in which it is insufficient. One is that we're dealing here with failure to fulfill a positive commandment. And a plea that is acceptable for failure to fulfill a positive commandment may not be sufficient to avoid liability for actually violating a negative commandment. But I think the second and more compelling case is that there are alternative explanations of the Rambam, particularly saying that there is no specific time. Despite the Rambam's claim that if you haven't fulfilled it ordinarily by 20, that you have sinned grievously. But in fact, it's not a mitzvah whose time passes. All one's life, one is obligated to fulfill and one is capable of fulfilling the obligation to procreate. And all Ben Azai did was he kept pushing it off and pushing it off, and then he happened to die before he fulfilled it. So long as Ben Azai never explicitly decided that he would never fulfill it, it might be that the mitzvah of Torah is sufficient to enable him to push off this commandment. Okay, so which means we now have an Acharon to go along with the Bechor Shor, the Rishon, seems to believe that there is such a plea, not clear that he extends it to criminal cases, not clear that his evidence is compelling. Okay, that brings us to source number 9, which appears in the Talmud, both in the Tractate Zvachim 102b, Kuf Bet Amid Bet, and in Kedushin, Lamed Gimel Amid Aleph 33a. Amar Rava, Rava said, Hai Dina, Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon, Gemirna, De Amar Rav Esa Kisei, etc. Rava quotes Halacha, he says, I learned this Halacha from Rabbi Lazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon, in the bathroom. So the Talmud asks, in the bathroom? But Rava Bar Brachana said, Nein Rabbi Yochanan, B'chol Makom Mutar Lahar Herachutzei Merachatz Veta Kisei. Right, you're entitled to think about Torah everywhere, except in the bathhouse, and in the bathroom. So on, how could Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon, say this halacha to Rava? So the Gemara answers la'on so shani, that when under compulsion is different. And what it seems to mean here is that some people are so compelled to think about Torah that they're simply not capable of not thinking about Torah in the bathroom. There are all sorts of interesting stories about contemporary rabbis having shower radios so that they could avoid thinking about Torah in the shower by playing radios the entire time. So here again it seems that we have an action which would otherwise be forbidden, thinking about Torah in the bathroom, which we treat somebody as absolved of responsibility for because they're under compulsion, they're so absorbed in Torah. So perhaps this should be treated as sufficient evidence for Bechor Shor. So I think again here that it's not quite enough for a number of reasons. One is that it's very likely that the prohibition against learning Torah in the bathroom is only rabbinic. So this might be evidence that you're absolved of responsibility for violating rabbinic prohibitions under internal compulsion, but that you could not use such a plea in biblical cases. And a second question is whether allowing yourself to be overwhelmed by a generally positive passion, such as that for Torah, is something that we account for, which is not the same as saying that we would allow you to give in to a negative passion, such as bloodlust. Furthermore, it's possible that since this is only a rabbinic case, that we could argue that the rabbis wish to encourage people to be utterly absorbed in Torah, and if they were to hold people accountable for learning in bathrooms, then people would have great hesitancy about really total dedication to Torah, because they would know that that would inevitably bring them into violation. And therefore, this might be, as in source number 7, a case where the rabbis chose not to make their decree, and they declare that somebody who's so absorbed in Torah that they have no choice but to think about it all the time is not subject to the prohibition against learning in the bathroom. Again, this is predicated on the claim that prohibition is rabbinic. I'm not sure there's any good evidence one way or the other on that question. So the evidence begins to add up for Bechor Shor. All right, that brings us to source number 10. Source number 10 is Gemara in Shvuot, Daf Chav Vav Amud Aleph. Shavuot 26a. Amar Mar, so we begin with by re-quoting a statement. Ha'adam bishvuah, which is a quote from the Torah. Prat la'anus, so a person is accountable for violating their oath unless they made the oath under compulsion. So Talmud wants to know, what's the case of a violation, unless they violated the oath under compulsion? Perhaps they made the oath under compulsion. We'll see how you interpret it. So what's the case of an oath or an oath under compulsion? So the Talmud says that the case is like Rav Kahana and Rav Asi. In what sense is it like the case? What's the case of Rav Kahana and Rav Asi? Because Kihavu Kaimi Mekami de Rav, when they were standing before Rav, it's not clear whether this happened once or whether this would happen continually. One of them, but I think it only happened once. One of them said, "I swear that Rav said the following." One of them said, "No. I swear that Rav said the other thing, the opposite." So when they came later back to Rav, he said, "You know, one of you was right and one of you was wrong." So Amar Le'idach, the other one said, Vana b'shikra ishtavai. Does that mean that I swore falsely about what Rav said, that I'm liable for having made a false oath? Amar Le'ich, so Rav said to this worried student, Libcha anascha, your heart compelled you. So here, we seem to have a clear case where somebody violated an oath, and we hold them not liable for violating their oath because they were under internal compulsion. Their heart compelled them. So that would seem to be a pretty good case for Bechor Shor, although the problem is that this is actually a very difficult case to understand. Why? Since the person at the time they made the oath, right, did not intend to swear falsely, right? Clearly they believe what they were saying is true, so this should be treated as a case of Shvuah B'Shogeg, of a mistaken oath, as opposed to a false oath, and it's not at all clear why that's not the case. Furthermore, one can argue that the point here is not that someone is unliable for having sworn a false oath. The point here is that taking an oath requires a certain amount of capacity to exercise judgment, and if somebody takes an oath under great overwhelming emotional stress, so we view that as anybody looking at him would say, that person isn't really intending to commit themselves in that way, and therefore it's not genuinely an oath. It's not that we hold you not liable for having made a false oath, it's that we invalidate the oath as such. But these are explanations. It seems to me that the simplest reading of this case would support Bechor Shor's claim that there are cases in which internal compulsion is a legitimate plea. Although we note again here that that one can view this as being overcome by a positive as opposed to a negative passion. That this is all part of their dedication to Torah. Although one could also see this as being involved in ego issues, which would be a negative reading. It seems to me, though, that the more likely reading of the story is that we treat them as being overwhelmed by their passion for truth. So that wouldn't quite tell us something about somebody committing a murder out of lust or something like that. Although, again, it's a very vague distinction, because one might argue that in the classic case, that one kills one's spouse out of a passion for social morality or out of human love as opposed to lust, could be. Okay, one more case. This is a Gemara, case number, source number 11, the Gemara in Ksuvot, Daf Nun Aleph Amud Bet, 51b. The Gemara in Ksuvot says the following, in the midst of a longer discussion, we're only interested in this narrow line for now, Rava said, Kol shetchilata be'ones v'sof perason muteret. Right, so the general rule is that if a wife commits adultery willingly, that she and her husband are then required to divorce. They're no longer allowed to be intimate. So Rava says, what about a case which begins as rape, in which case there would be no prohibition, but it ends consensually? We don't know, although the simplest reading is that this is a specific act. And I'd rather not get into the issues of whether such a case is realistic or not. We can treat it simply as an abstract discussion. If it's talking about an ongoing circumstance as opposed to a particular act, so then this would be what is known in modern terms as Stockholm Syndrome, where somebody falls in love with the captor. But Rava says, in principle, if you have a case which begins, I think it makes much more sense as a specific act, which begins as onus, as rape, and ends piratzon, and ends willing, muteret, then the wife is nonetheless, even though the end of the sexual act was willing, the wife is permitted to remain intimate with her husband. My Tama, why should this be? Because yetzer alavsha, because desire overwhelmed her. So here it seems that, you know, ordinarily the act of adultery carries a specific consequence. Let's assume that there aren't witnesses, so we're not, or at least there aren't witnesses in such a way that we could in fact exercise capital jurisdiction and execute the woman for adultery. But there's a lesser consequence for adultery, which is the prohibition to the husband. And Rava says that in this case we don't hold someone accountable for that act, because desire overwhelmed her. And that would seem to be really a very strong piece of evidence for Bechor Shor's position. The only distinction one can really make it, at this point, well, I guess one can make two distinctions. One distinction is that it's very possible that the wife in question here has no physical choice, right? The sexual act will happen regardless of her choices, right? Meaning that the rapist will not cease the act of rape because she's unwilling, as evidence that he began it. However, right, the only thing that she can control is her attitude. And we don't hold people legally liable for a change, right, for a change in intent under, right, under duress, as opposed to a change in action. And furthermore, she's not being overwhelmed.